You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, and we are here with one of my favorite interview subjects, or most favorite interview subjects, Spike of Me First and the Gimme Gimmies, Spike of Swingin' Utters, Spike of Filthy Thieves and Bastards, and Spike of the Chuckleberries, which not a lot of people know. Let's open with one of the new Me First songs, Estos Celos, which is, I believe, This Jealousy, and we'll be right back.
All right, we got a couple more, but we got some friends coming up to join us. Mr. Jason and Mr. Keith, Mr. Keith and Mr. Jason, we have a wind section for the very first time in our band's storied existence. This is our very first time with a wind section with horn players, not to mention ones as accomplished as these two, and they deserve your prolonged and genuine applause and enthusiasm, and I'm hoping you guys will come up and dance with us. Dance like nobody's watching, although we are, and judging. So please, dance accordingly, but dance. Just dance, all right? Everybody ready?
Sensual, te imaginé ajena y me hizo mal. Ay, amor, ay, qué dolor. Qué tarde comprendí, contigo tenía todo y lo perdí. Te miré, con tu melena al viento. De tu escote, tu lugar. Ay, ay, amor. Ay, ay, qué dolor. Hoy muero de pensar que no vaya a ser yo el que vas a amar. Estos son los meses de año, me enloquecen. Jamás aprenderé a vivir sin ti. Lo peor es que muy tarde. Tenía todo y lo perdí. Contigo tenía todo y lo perdí.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Stay on the floor, because we got plenty more where that comes from.
And we're back. Spike, did I translate that correctly? Is Estos Celos This Jealousy?
Yeah, exactly. It's plural in Spanish. But I mainly just learned the stuff phonetically, you know, like my Spanish is improving, but it's still got a long way to go.
What's interesting, I guess, now, Spike, you're originally from the Pittsburgh area, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and, I am.
A lot of your art, I guess, has Latin music influence or is directly Latin, like your band Los Nuevos Bajos. Are you just a big fan of Latin music, or why do you find yourself repeatedly returning to Latin music, Mexican music, and South American music?
Nothing to do with Pittsburgh other than it sounded really exotic when I first heard it. And then once I started listening more and more to certain kinds of songs, especially boleros, they're beautiful. They're such well-written songs. They're like pop songs, like Beatles songs with some more minor chords. And then slowly I started to learn the words to the song, and then the lyrics were really beautiful too. And then the way they were played in the 50s and 60s by groups like Los Panchos and Los Tecolines, Los Tres Aces, groups like that, really turned me on to this whole new. And then cumbia music too, because it's just got such a great beat. We actually toured with a great cumbia band called Son Rompe Pera, and they're from Mexico City, and really, really good. I just saw them here in San Francisco, in fact. I don't know. Just different, fun, danceable.
So are you like a music archaeologist? Like, do you study like a whole bunch of like different like genres to see where they came from? Or what? And you know, I mean, that kind of ties in, you know, with me first is, you guys cover so many different genres. So you go back to AM pop, you go to Australian music, you go to divas. Are you sort of a music archaeologist, or do you just play what you like and what you hear on the radio? You know what I mean? Like, do you make it a mission to dig up music, or are you just carried by the currency? That's the question.
You know, I love collecting records, and so that's always been a thing for me. And I guess I just like stuff, and occasionally I'll look it up like in a Wikipedia entry or something like that. But I'm usually embarrassingly ignorant about the stuff I listen to and the people and the personnel, et cetera. I don't know that I'm an archive. I do know some people that actually do that work here in the Bay Area with Latin music. They're called the Arholi Archive, Arholie, and they're definitely worth looking up. They're digitizing just this vast catalog of historical Latin music. But me, I just collect records, and you know, the first couple of records that we did, those songs were chosen more by Mike and Joey, because I never listened to show tunes. I don't know anything about show tunes. I would never have been able to curate the songs for that record, nor the first record, because AM, you know, adult contemporary is not ever what I listened to. But trying to transform it into something that I could dig was maybe part of what makes it sound different. You know, it's like, once you get over the presentation, the sort of like 70s, I don't know, it's like having tepid water just spilled over your head. You know what I mean? It's just like so light and kind of mediocre and do-do-do kind of sounding. And but underneath it were like pretty cool songs, and songs that ironically translated great into songs played in the punk idiom. I didn't pick the I'm not an archivist. In other words, I don't know shit. I know what I like.
Well, and actually that's a question, and M, if you'll notice, like Spike has such great answers that all his answers have like three or four questions you can go off of, so I'm just going to try to hit some in a row.
Some people call that mental illness, but
I call it a thoughtful a thoughtful person. Anyway, Spike,
thank you.
The songs that Me First covers, do you like them all, or do you hate them and see some of them, and you see if you can make yourself like them, or do you cover some and you hate them and you still hate them after you cover them? You know,
A little bit of A, a little bit of B, a little bit of C, all of the above, essentially. A song that's going to work is a song that I like, ironically, at best. That otherwise, I just don't see the point in doing it necessarily. Like, if it's a rock song or even a punk song that I liked, like, it doesn't, the last word has already been said, so to speak. You know, there are things that I wouldn't, like, I don't want to do the Beatles or the Stones, you know, or the Yardbirds. But those are bands that I love, but would just never think of doing, because I can't see like trance. It would just sort of sound clownish. You know, we can tell within about 15 minutes whether a song is going to work or not, And usually it's the songs that require the least amount of effort, ironically, that are the ones that are going to be the most successful.
Spike said they're not. He's not going to cover the Beatles or the Stones, which is a obscure homage or a slight homage to the Clash, of course, who are slightly covered on the new record. I think it's
Yes.
Dancing Queen, where you guys do a slight Jamie Jones cover into Dancing Queen.
Yes, indeed. And out of it.
So there you go. I guess one of the very fun things about Me First Record, and especially the new one, is they'll slip in like, have you ever fallen in love with someone you shouldn't have, or Jamie Jones and the Dancing Queen? Is there is the connection random juxtaposition, or do you try to find your thread? For let's use Jamie Jones and Dancing Queen on the new record. I used to not like ABBA, and now I love ABBA, or I should say ABBA. I love ABBA now. When you connect Jamie Jones to ABBA's Dancing Queen on the new record, is that random juxtaposition, or are you trying to find a thread to tie those two together, either musically or conceptually?
The first time that we ever did it conceptually is a song that you might play a little bit later, which is Love Will Keep Us Together. And in that case, it was you'll hear the irony once you hear the beginning of it. But no, otherwise it's just like I said, 15 minutes of slapping things together and throwing them against the wall and seeing what sticks. And yeah, and that's it. It's what sounds right. But in this one case with Love Will Keep Us Together, that was actually a stroke of genius on our drummer's part. It was his idea because we had already been toying around with the idea of covering Love Will Keep Us Together, but we sandwiched it with something you might recognize.
The new record has a lot of of course Spike is literally one of the best singers in punk rock and even in rock, if you will. I want to
Thank
talk
you.
about his contributions to other acts. Well, a briefly I'll mention is Spike's contribution to Dwarves Records takes some of those records from being super great to being insanely awesome when Spike lays on those high-pitched vocals or higher vocals on the top. But
Thank you.
on this
I'm gonna
record.
tell Blag you said that, man. Like and try to up my rate.
With Blag, we'll see. At any rate, you've got CJ and Swami John Rhys on this record.
Yes.
This is the first one with CJ on it, isn't it? Or CJ on the
Yes,
last
it
one
is.
too?
But we've been
Yeah,
playing
okay.
with him for a long time.
So what's it like being up there on stage and on record with a Ramone? I mean, he's a legit Ramone, you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely is. And I occasionally have to remind myself because he's such a humble and gracious and all around nice dude. And a great travel companion, great player. And everybody loves him, and everybody loves the Ramones. We just went down to Los Angeles. He played the Hollywood Forever Cemetery for Johnny Ramone's birthday with Tim Armstrong. Billy Idol sang a couple songs. John Travolta came to because it was the 30th anniversary of Pulp Fiction as well. It was this crazy night, but yeah, CJ was there, and it was great seeing him. Great seeing him play those songs. Great seeing he sang the songs too. Yeah, no, occasionally I have to remind myself that, I am sharing the stage or even just a living room with a Ramone. But no, he's a super sweet dude.
You don't have to comment on this, but I'm kind of actually I'm very happy that CJ seemed to be finally getting his just due or in the past 5 or 6 years, because when he was in the Ramones and just after the Ramones, people kind of said, oh, well, he's stepping in for Dee Dee, and no one can step in for Dee Dee, and which I mean, listen, no one can replace Dee Dee. And also, it seems as though, and you don't have to comment, it seems as though maybe the Ramones didn't give him as much juice as they should have, on tour and stuff. So I'm glad that people are enjoying CJ solo stuff. I'm glad that they're clapping for him and excited for him at Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. To me, it seems from the outside looking in, it's sort of a CJ redemption, which I'm very thrilled to see,
Absolutely. And you never know, like they may not have treated Dee Dee any better than they treated
True,
CJ. You
true.
know what I'm saying? As far as like respect and space and all that kind of stuff. But no, and to fill Dee Dee's shoes, I think it would require a Marine like CJ. And so I don't know. Like he's definitely as big shoes of shoes as those were to fill. CJ is an estimable human being. You know, like he's a wild man too. He's not just a nice dude. You know.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah.
What does he give you that's wild? Because he's always so quiet in interviews. He's always very even keeled. You know.
I don't know. He knows how to have a good time, man. CJ knows how to have a good time in a way that I never have. I'm socially awkward, and just being around people like that, I get to experience things I wouldn't normally have done or situations. And, you know, he's just his gracious, charming quality gets him into some weird cool spaces, you know, and sometimes I get to go with him.
See, I'm very surprised that you're socially awkward, because on stage, you're so confident, you're so in charge, and you're in on the whole idea that is me first in the Gimme Gimmes. It's kind of funny, but it's also musically serious, if you will, you know? So I'm very surprised that you're socially awkward. You're so natural on stage.
Well, thank you for saying that, but I'm just, like, sort of trolling people, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, maybe it's response to my childhood or my hangups or whatever, but I just love to troll people to the point of public displays and expressions of disapproval, and then somehow manage to, through music and you know, maybe a little conciliatory speech, to reel them back in by the end of the set. And ironically, when people are the most disapproving and even to the point of booing, that ends up being the time when you sell the most t-shirts, ironically enough. You know what I mean? I think there's something about, like, human nature and entertainment. Like, there's always got to be a little bit of trolling, especially if you're trying to make people laugh or trying to provoke people, because a cover band would just be, you know, just a bar cover band otherwise. Like, I think the songs are good. I love them and I love playing them. I love playing the new songs. And the Quinceañera recording, an event, like, it was an actual event and it was a troll, but it wasn't, you know, like a punked, I hope, you know what I mean? She was a really good sport, but she also, there were snacks, refreshments. There was a DJ in the intermission and at the end that played for hours, songs that they actually recognized from, like, the current millennium. But at least initially, they did not, nobody knew who we were. Nobody was inclined to particularly liking us. And some of our humor was a little off color, so to speak, and not everybody appreciated it. And some people were kind of walking out. But by the end of the show, when we played that song that you just heard, Estos Celos, I had some shakers. Everybody came out onto the floor. Abuelo dug the music, which kind of got everybody else into it. And from then on, it the night kind of redeemed itself. But, you know, like the first set, side one, so to speak, it was touch and go. But I think it will be entertaining to the listener more so than like what's better? Frampton Comes Alive. You know, they probably even added applause. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Or like five people sort of politely clapping, you know, and looking at their phones. I think that's a way funnier live record. And, you know, maybe it's sort of more indicative of our actual live set, you know, to troll and provoke and people to the point, you know, where they may not like it. They don't know whether to be offended or entertained. Or so in that case, we've done our job. We've actually gotten hate mail. We've actually gotten hate mail. Like some of our bits, people think that they're real. So it's it's interesting.
I should have mentioned off the bat, the new Me First and the Gimme Gimme's record. It's great. It's one of my favorite ones by them. It's called Me First and the Gimme Gimme's Blow It at Madison's Quinceañera. Which
Quinceañera. Sweet 15. This is a Sweet 15 birthday party. It's fun for the whole family. And, you know, eventually we won the folks over, or at least most of them, the ones that hadn't left already.
And the record is great because it's not that I'm a huge Andrew Dice Clay record, but there's that famous Andrew Dice Clay comedy record where he goes into a club and specifically like it's hostile and the crowd doesn't get it. And I like here a lot, actually. And actually, Spike brings up a great point is, you know, Judas Priest and Leech and the East, great live record. The audience is going nuts. You know, Kiss Alive, the audience is going nuts. Here, Me First and the Gimme Gimmes are facing a hostile crowd and even kind of agitate the crowd, which gives the record a whole different feel and a very punk feel, if you will. I mean, you comment on it a little bit, but what's it like being against the crowd instead of being with the crowd? Which is funny because usually cover bands by their nature are with, like, how many cover bands are they to cover Journey and everyone sings that? What's that Journey song?
Don't Stop Believing.
Right. Where you guys come in almost in an, you guys almost come in attack style. Like, what's the rush behind that? You know,
you forgot Unleashed in the East. It's something, I don't know, about my childhood, my upbringing, my hang-ups, malignant narcissism, maybe. It's just like, if you can't turn entertaining into coping as well as performing, you know, then or if put it a better way, if you can, then, you know, it's a pretty sweet spot. It can be a good job.
How'd you guys get hired? Because you didn't know her before doing it. How'd you get hired for this gig? Like, did you guys like put out like a fake ad in the newspaper or something? Or how'd you?
Yeah, that's actually, so 91X, a radio station in San Diego, California. They were the first people to play Seasons in the Sun when it came out back in 96 or 97. And like to play it just out on the air. And we knew we wanted to do it, you know, somewhere in Southern California. And we thought, why not San Diego? They have a big reach all over San Diego County. And it was a contest. People, you know, it was still kind of COVID. I mean, it still is kind of. But you know what I'm saying? So people weren't able to do a lot of the things that they wanted to do over the last couple of years, like throw a quinceañera party for their daughter. And so a bunch of people entered, and we did vet the contestants just to make sure there was nothing untoward. Like in one case, I think there was a custody dispute. And we didn't want fans necessarily. We wanted people who had not heard of us, who did not know who we were, because we thought that would be a more entertaining live record. That was about it. And it ended up being Madison, her mom Jessica, her dad Tony, and they were great, and they had a good time. And the sun came down right during our second set. This beautiful sunset.
Is that the real Madison on the cover, or is that like a staged picture?
No, that's the real Madison. There are all sorts of. There's like a photo album inside of the record, and you'll see sort of there are all sorts of moments from the evening, delicious moments, I would add. The whole thing was real. It was videoed too by our friend Josh Roosh, and his crew, and so it's all real. It was not prefabricated. You can see it in some of the promos that we put out on social media, but just to assure the people that it's not a prefabricated. The same as Johnny's Bar Mitzvah. I don't think it would have been the same. See, I think. Any record is it's like an event that sort of snowballs through time and sort of achieves like a mythical status based on like people interpreting and reinterpreting and misinterpreting it and sort of ascribing all these qualities to it that weren't necessarily put in. And in this case, the cheat code was just to play an actual event, like a family event. And have that, you know, like people can make up in their own minds what it was like being there. And I think it kind of transports you to a world, which is what a record's supposed to do, which is what people sort of forgot to do and what made it easy for people to download and stream and not pay any money, or, you know, for artists not to be compensated for it, was that there were like maybe three good songs on a record, and that was the business model, where it's supposed to take you into a separate world from your own. And I hope that this record does. It might be like awkward and even tragic at some points, but it's definitely funny. And I like the music. We branched out into a different language, I think successfully. I hope so. So yeah.
Well, what a fantastic summarization of the record. It's called Me First and the Gimme Gimme's Blow It at Madison's Quinceañera. It's out June 14 via Fat Records. Definitely one of my favorite Me First records. The songs are awesome. Honestly, if you ask me, it's one of the best concepts that the band has ever done. Plus, you know, the crew on this one is fantastic. One last question, then we'll play a song. And, of course, Spike mentioned Josh Roush, who did I forget the name. He did a pretty cool movie. The character was Cat Odin. And it was like the punk rock movie or whatever. I'll see if I can remember the name of it. But he did a neat movie, and there's a soundtrack with that too. He also is one of the guys that films the punk in the Tim Armstrong's backyard thing, Music Cares or something like that. Anyways, we're not talking about Josh. We're talking about Spike.
He's
Spike's
great.
Fantastic new record.
No,
Spike. Last question. You said you collected a lot of records. What are some of the crown jewels in your record collection?
I don't know. Just be stuff that I like. The Saints, Eternally Yours. I don't know, as far as like old valuable records, because I don't really think of it that way. That just means I spent a lot of money for it. But, you know, I was able to forget the pain over time. And it's just sort of enjoyment. Like, I buy them to play them. So Saints, Eternally Yours. Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life, is another great one to listen to. All my Los Panchos and Los Tecolines records, just because they're two of my favorite groups. Yeah, that's about it. I don't know if I have any crown jewels. I don't think my record collection is worth that much, actually. Oh, Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables with the heads still intact.
Spike is referring to the Dead Kennedys Special for Rotting Vegetables, which there are multitude versions of that jacket. The original version had like an oldies act on the back, and then they actually threatened to sue the Dead Kennedys. So yes. And the next versions either said censored or they cut off the heads, or put like there's all the different versions. Plus, Spike is also has the Porky's Prime Cut version, which is the version you want to get as per Jell-O. It is according to Jell-O the very best mix of that record. Anyway. Let's play a song. We'll come back and we'll hit some news. Spike is a great guy. I love talking to Spike. We're going to have him on the news,
Thank
too.
Thank you.
The new record, Me First and the Gimme Gimme's, Blow It at Madison's Quinceañera. Great record. Super enjoyable. We are going to play Love Will Keep Us Together, and we'll be right back.
Would you settle for Captain and Tennille? We'll be right back. All right. All right. Yes. Yes. All right. All right.
And we're back, and I'm going to give Spike a quick break while I hit M with a question about some new news, and then Spike can chip in. Dwarves have a new record coming out. It's called Dwarves, Keep It Real. It's a companion to the excellent Dwarves concept album. The new record is called Dwarves, Keep It Real, which has 7 new songs on it, 2 remixes, and 1 single from Dwarves concept record. Yours truly did the special edition covers. One is a board game and the other is a parody of Magical Mystery Tour. I'm super excited for it. I know for you, the Dwarves are hit and miss. I know you're not thrilled over the Dwarves, but do you think the Dwarves should have released this as a double LP with concept record, or do you like it's coming in two sections, if you will?
I like...
And what do you think of concept record if you listen to it?
I have not listened to it. the board game looks fun, though. I want to play the board game. I think it's good that they released it as two parts because, like, again, I love listening to music. I think it's great. But sometimes double LPs or double albums are way too long. And it's just like, I want to listen to part of it and then go and, like, do something else and then come back and really enjoy it instead of kind of being like, ah, yes, I'm climbing the mountain that is, like, whatever. You know, so I'm a fan of separate releases. I think it's fun. Bite size.
Spike, you've contributed to multiple Dwarves records. What's it like getting in there? How does it feel to be a part of the Dwarves family? And I don't know if you've checked out a concept record yet or not, or if you're excited for Keep It Real or your perspective on the Dwarves in general.
So Blood, Guts, and Pussy, obviously a classic. Thank Heavens for Little Girls, another timeless classic, because it's hard to place when it's from, like, almost impossible, like, what year is this, you know what I mean? And just classic songs. They're like a Johnny Ryan comic book is what the Dwarves remind me of, like a musical version of a Johnny Ryan, like, especially those records. But then Sugarfix, I really like Sugarfix because it's just kind of like a weird, like, it's not grunge by any means, but it's definitely 90s damaged, and it's got a great poppy kind of quality to it. So yeah, I love their stuff. And he's a good friend, you know, based here in the same city. Yeah, we see each other a lot.
One thing about Blag is he's very much, I don't know if he would accept this or not, but he's very much like George Clinton in that he's smart and that he doesn't always need to be the center star. And instead, he picks people like Spike or like Josh Fries that can highlight the record and make it better. And so he's willing to give up, I guess, a little bit of the spotlight to improve the overall piece of art. So, Spike, what's it like being the guy that comes in and adds the high harmonies to the Dwarves? What's it like being that guy?
I don't know. He gets me baked. I hang out, watch a little TV, wait for my time, and then try to fill up my time as well as I can. He knows what he wants, and that is definitely helpful. And I like the material. I like his weird sort of take on, you know, I always thought 90s pop punk was a weird. I always thought the Ramones were a pop punk band and that the 90s bands were just kind of like Adolescents and Descendants acolytes and Bad Religion. You know what I'm saying? Like it, my pop punk, in other words, is different. And the Dwarves are kind of like a pop punk band to me. And I appreciate his take on it. I appreciate that he goes into, you know, weird sort of genre bending explorations, you know, even if it's not my cup of tea, it's just, you know, he keeps exploring.
well, there you have it. I guess, Spike mentioned about like only 3 good songs on some records and stuff. There's a new documentary coming out called How Music Got Free. It's executive produced by Eminem and LeBron James. 50 Cent in it. It's a lot of hip-hop stars, I guess, because that's kind of what was the, I guess, prime moneymaker during the Napster era. And the documentary follows the rise and fall of Napster and somewhat considers how the transfer from physical music to digital music has affected the market and artists themselves. I have very strong opinions on the idea in general. As to the documentary, I mean, the documentary looks cool. To me, it kind of feels like that old VH1 show, I Remember the 90s or I Remember the 80s. They'll be like, Pogs! Who remembers Pogs? And they don't really provide any elucidation on Pogs or Beanie Babies. It's like, who remembers Beanie Babies? So this documentary, while I guess somewhat interesting to me, just kind of looks like Napster came and it changed the game and things will never be the same. And that was Napster. So I'm not super psyched on the documentary. I'm probably still going to watch it. But honestly, ever since I remember when Napster first came around, people were like, music should be free or you know, only the record labels are making money anyway. So I never felt that way. I always felt that artists should be paid appropriately. But the fact is, now that physical music has more or less been wiped out, although there certainly hasn't been a resurgence of records, it's never going to release the heights of what it was. And I think I point the blame at the fans. And I really think the fans chose ease, that is digital music or streaming music, over kind of supporting art. And so in a way that in the 90s, there was this huge thing all the time. Don't sell out. So-and-so is selling out. The idea of selling out is almost completely gone because no artists are making money at all. So an artist could do a commercial for Mercedes-Benz or for Taco Bell, and fans wouldn't bat an eye. And I don't think they should at this point. But you know, back in the day, that would have been career suicide. And so where am I going with this? I'm going, while corporations and even the record company are still making money just through various different channels, artists are getting the squeeze now more than ever. I think it's lame, but I don't think it's going to change. Buzz Osborne of the Melvins has a very interesting point on this. He says, well, during the height of the 90s, artists didn't get paid, and they're not getting paid now, so what's the difference? I think his statement is perhaps oversimplified, because certainly bands of medium caliber could make a comfortable living touring and selling records. Now they can't really. But prior to 97, I think his point is well taken. So I guess here's my perspective. I think Spotify's lame. I think it's amazing that Spotify's business model was, what if we just don't pay bands? And then all the bands signed up for it, which blew my mind. I guess hindsight 2020. And I think it's lame, and I think you should buy records, but are things going to change? No. I think art perhaps have suffered to a degree in that I hate to throw a bunch of quotes around, but Jesse Michael has a great quote, and he's like, I'd rather see an artist make money off music than wasting their efforts flipping hamburgers when they could be making music. So I agree with that. That being said, it's harder for artists now, and that's just how it's going to be. And more, are you excited for this documentary? Yes. And do you hate streaming as much as I do? Or do you see as it as, John, get with it. Things are evolving. Evolve or die. Adapt or die.
Okay, I have a very interesting relationship with like that whole thing. So I've never had.
What if Emma's like, I work for Spotify now?
Yeah, so, actually, I'm the new CEO. I've done a coup, and Daniel Ek is out, and I'm in. So watch out. I'm actually going to pay people now. The company's going to go bankrupt. But yeah, I've never had a lot of money. I've never been able to save up and buy something is an event, you know? So I've never used Napster because it wasn't a thing when I was using the internet. I have used free music downloaders to be like, well, I want to know what these songs are. I want to see what's out there. And then when I was able to, I bought the physical media, or I bought concert tickets, or I bought merch. Like, you know what I mean? I supported them when I could. I'm not a fan of streaming services. That said, I do have to use them in certain circumstances, which really sucks. And it's like, you know, if I could get everything on physical media, or I could pay for everything, that would be the ideal. I do think that there is a happy medium. I do think things will work out and balance out in some way. I don't know what that's going to look like, but I know that's going to have to happen in some way, shape, or form. And yeah, listening to things before digital media kind of comes in, like Spike, like you said, like the albums having like more of a story, and like the track list is intentional, and it's like you start with a beginning, middle, and end, and you have like that journey and that story. And then sometimes, like with some of the stuff that's out now, it's like there's not that, and it's just like, oh, is this like a punchy enough single or whatever? So I do think we are starting to see more of a trend back to making intentional albums, because I think a lot of people are really fed up with like, well, I bought this and it all sounds the same, or like there's only two good songs. So I think there's going to be a shift culturally, and that's going to affect the business side.
Amen.
Spike,
yeah.
What's your opinion on Bandcamp? What's your opinion on Spotify? Is it cool? Is it not cool? Is it an evil you just have to deal with? What's your stance on that kind of stuff?
I liked MySpace because it was a tool, and everything on the internet has turned from like a utilitarian platform into a sales platform.
Ah!
And Americans, English people, to some degree Europeans, but they complain and they have no space to, at least not to Americans. But the hot potato is in your lap and you got to get it out, you know? So I don't blame the fans for paying less money given the opportunity. You know, I think it should have been regulated by competent, maybe a little bit younger politicians. But no, I don't buy people I don't blame people for buying cheap stuff, because you got to pass the hot potato around. It burns, right? Like it's, and life is a struggle and everything is more and more expensive. But no, I mean, it's just like the news, it's the same difference. It's a testament to the popularity of music, because everybody wanted it in their life. So if you found a way to give it away, which was one of the first things that was given away, well, print and, you know, music, then you're going to get rich. You are going to be rich. But it's also a testament to how crucial music is to people's lives, whether they admit it or not, or whether they think it's worth paying for. People don't think it's worth paying for news now, and we see kind of where that's going. You know, like it's worth something, and I don't know if money is it, you know. To me, you know, I don't know. I hate to say this. I know a lot of people with kids, but it feels like the late 80s in Soviet Union. You know what I mean? It's kind of what it feels like.
I agree. So, and I wish I could be as insightful and as eloquent as Spike. I'm like, naps are bad. And then Spike gives this academic treatise on the intersection of art, commerce, and sociology. Two more quick stories. This next one is an M favorite. Morrissey is re-releasing his live record, Beethoven Was Deaf, and he's hinted that he is going to finally release his long-delayed album, Bonfire of Teenagers, which has been in suspension since he got in a big fight with his last record label, which was it, I'm trying to remember who it was. It wasn't EMI, it was Polydor. Anyways, he got in a big argument with his last record label, and it looks like he may have freed his album. Of course, as a listener, surely you know, Morrissey used to be known as the champion of the disenchanted, champion of the underdog. Since I guess taking that throne, he has sort of besmirched that throne by making a lot of very iffy and suspicious comments. None of those comments have been directly literal and said, I believe X or I believe Y, but he has been very clear in saying, you don't know what I believe, but then him not saying what he believes. A lot of people have felt that Morrissey has turned their back on them and turned back on what he used to stand for, and are now refusing to listen to him. I am a huge Smiths fan, huge Morrissey fan, not Morrissey the person, Morrissey the art. And I'll say it's been difficult for me because I certainly disagree with a lot of things Morrissey says, and he said a lot of things that are very iffy, but he hasn't quite crossed that line, thankfully for me. So to a degree, I can turn a blind eye and say, well, as long as he doesn't cross that line, I can still enjoy the art. I will say I've seen Morrissey three times. He's an amazing singer, an absolutely amazing singer, an amazing performer. And his newest records are some of his best. I'm psyched that he's releasing Beethoven Was Deaf on vinyl, because that's been out of print on vinyl since it was released in 1992 or something. I'm psyched for the new record. I've heard some of the new songs live, and they're great. I just wish Morrissey, much like John Lydon, would just say, oh, I was kidding. I didn't mean those things that I said or that I suggested. I'm just kidding, you know. And Morrissey, is he destroyed forever, or can Morrissey redeem Morrissey? And absent Morrissey's suspicious statements, which he has not been concrete about but has been suspicious, do you enjoy the Morrissey / Mists catalog? And Spike, I want you to ponder this while M answers, because Spike, renowned for his voice, he's very deft with his voice. He's very on point and very specific, much like Morrissey. I wonder if Spike feels a vocal parody with Morrissey or not. So Spike, I'd like you to think about that while M answers whether or not she thinks Morrissey should be burned at the stake with the bonfire of teenagers.
Don't steal my answer, M.
I have a whole essay on your voice and Morrissey's. I will read it now. first of all, I think Morrissey's a little too old to be burned in a bonfire of teenagers. But I don't agree with what he's been saying. If somebody's that cagey about it, you know they're, well, chances are pretty good. Like, they're on a pretty extreme point of view for the most part. So it's just kind of I liked the Smiths. I never really got into just Morrissey stuff, just never really did. So I've never listened to this album in particular. I don't really have many thoughts about it, but whenever somebody says something weird and doesn't really clarify it, it's always what are you trying to hide? You know? And it just makes me wonder.
So you got to give the thumbs up or the thumbs down, Em. Thumbs up or thumbs down. And are you excited for the new Morrissey album, which has long been delayed?
I'm not excited for it just because I don't know what his solo stuff is, so I'd say no.
Thumbs down for him. Spike, Morrissey, you don't have to give – I'm not looking to get you in a PR disaster. I'm just maybe you can comment on Morrissey's vocal styles and you know, maybe your own approach to keeping those golden pipes so golden.
He wrote at least a couple of iconic songs, you know, that I remember, that conquered the world, and it came from a space that I could sort of identify with and spoke to people that I empathized with. Does that make sense? And the vocal style, the presentation, the words, I thought it was really good. You know what I think with him, you know how there's a science, I guess, to songwriting and performing. I think there's a science to celebrity too. And I think he, you have to do kind of like a troll, you know, you have to show up super late. You have to ask for weird shit, you know, and then you have to I don't know, have a bidding war or an issue with your label or something like that. I mean, I'm sure it's actually genuine. He seems like a genuine curmudgeon, you know, but it's also, it's interesting that every time he does it, you know, we all talk about it. You know what I mean? He gets in the news, but yeah, I respect his certainly his early output, but no, I've never been a Morrissey fan either. And Johnny Marr's guitar playing was also a voice on those recordings that I was talking about that was part of what made it so transcendent.
What is the song?
I'm Human and I Want to Be Loved. What a great song.
I don't know the name. I mean, I would know that. I would know that song if I heard the title and this song, but is it Please Let Me Get What I Want? That's it. Bam. So anyways, I'm going to scrap our last story because Spike brings up a very interesting concept that ties back to the brand new Me First and the Gimme Records, Gimme Gimme Record, which is called, once again, Me First and the Gimme Gimme. He's Blow It at Madison's Quinceañera on June 14 via Fat Records. I'm going to quote Fat Mike, an early member of Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. Fat Mike once said that you can't always give the audience what they want. And of course, Mike brings that from the perspective of seeing like the Screamers back in the day or the Germs who would sometimes just totally be totally smashed.
I'll let Spike.
Suicide. Spike, Von Elmo. Suicide, did you?
Nobody heard of Von Elmo? Nobody? Come on.
What's that?
Von Elmo, like, so I would argue a contemporary of Suicide, just this weird kind of obscure punk figure, but like really abrasive keyboards. And check him out, Von Elmo, V-O-N-L-M-O was his name. But and also very sort of antagonistic, the way you're talking, like it's and that's part of the troll. That's the trolling is that that's what does it for me, you know, like musically, I just like cool pop songs, you know, but I do like to have just sort of an adversarial relationship with the audience, especially, I love punk music. Some of my best friends are punk, but especially like a dumb punk crowd, you know, like, shut up, I want to slam. You know what I mean? People actually tell you to shut up. Like, no, man. Like, now I'm going to talk longer. Now I'm going to talk longer. I'm going to make you in particular feel ridiculous for, you know, this is my time. And if you like it, you know, keep coming back. If you don't, then, you know, go like, I don't know. Go crowd kill somewhere else. Luckily, nobody does that at our shows, fortunately.
I am loving Spike's confidence. You know, Spike says, oh, I'm socially awkward, but then he takes a very much KRS-One attitude that this is my stage. I'm going to do what I want, and you have to deal with it, and that's that. So, Spike,
I saw him a few years ago, man. He like, I don't know if he was, I don't know if coherent is exactly what I would, but whatever. I think he fired his DJ that night, if I'm not mistaken. But that's something that we would do. So maybe it was a bit. You know what I mean? Like we would do something like that.
You aren't referring to the show at the Avalon Lounge from like 9 or 10 years ago, are you?
No, like a little bit more recent than that here at Slim's in San Francisco.
I love seeing KRS-One because you never know. I mean, I've seen him like 25 times because he plays the Bay Area all the time because he got like a house in Colorado or something. Mm-hmm. Like it is every show he does is just so crazy. And you have no, sometimes he'll just do greatest hits. Sometimes he'll freestyle for like 45 minutes and that's it. And anyway, but we'll talk about KRS-One some other time. Spike, we got to have you back on because we didn't even get to Hardy Ains. I wanted to talk about the Hunkies in Pittsburgh. I wanted to talk about Jesse Michaels and you knowing him. I wanted to talk about Swami John Reese. I wanted to talk about all your different acts. But we'll close this out by playing a act related to Spike. Yet another cover act is Spike was – Spike, you were briefly in the Chuckleberries or the Huckleberries, correct?
Are you talking about – Russell Kwan's band? I was never in that band. No, the Russell Kwan and the Chuckleberries, they're a Bay Area band. It was Russell and somebody else. Russell Kwan, I would love to, but he is one of the best drummers ever.
Isn't there some connection between you and Psychotic Pineapple, or am I totally blowing up?
Absolutely. Oh, okay. Yes. So I know Alex Carlin and John Seabury, Henriquez too. I know those guys. Absolutely. We used to play cover music together. And Hunkies, at least for me, Hunkies are Heschers. I think it was meant to be like an anti-Eastern European kind of like prejudicial sort of derogatory term, but for us they were Heschers. Like in California, I don't know. Do you have Heschers? From your accent, it doesn't sound like you have Heschers where you're at. But in California, they're called Heschers. And those were like the dudes in the metal t-shirts or the Bon Jovi. You know what I mean? That would beat the shit out of you like on site. You know what I mean? And Pittsburgh, actually, a lot of those, man. It was a failing steel town.
You know, I was wrapping this up, but you bring. I got to ask you one last question. That I promise I'm going to let you go. You talked about, you know, the threat of Heschers beating you up or whatever. Is I used to go see Slayer back in the 90s. And in the East Coast, like, seeing Slayer in the 90s was dangerous. There were definitely dudes there. There were neo-Nazis there that were roided out that would say outside the venue, I'm going to get in a fight tonight. And they would literally get in huge brawls. And, like, seeing Slayer in the 90s was dangerous. Now shows, pretty much every show, is much, much safer. In a way, that's good. But in a way, that's sad. There was some kind of statement or feeling or even artistic statement that Slayer is up there being the baddest ass band ever, and you're in an area of danger. There's something to that art. Do you agree to that, or do you think that it's just nice that everything's nice and safer now in concerts?
If it's violence, it sucks to be that guy or that girl. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, I've been jumped before, and I've been to shows where, like, I saw some really shitty stuff happened and wish that I had not. On the other hand, I remember, like, in specific, some of the shows I saw at the Electric Banana in Pittsburgh, and some of those are very violent too. Some of the shows that I saw at Gilman Street in particular, I remember seeing Neurosis back when they would play mostly with Christ on Parade. They had this warehouse and practice space called the New Method out in Emeryville. And I remember it was when, like, a lot of those bands, Op Ivy too, were drawing a bunch of people that you didn't know to that venue and who, you know, had never been to Gilman Street or anything like that. So there was obviously this kind of buzz going around about these bands. But I remember there was this enormous circle pit in the middle of Gilman, and something about the lights, or maybe about, like, the way the band was standing or holding their instruments. And it just seemed so transgressive and, like, satanic, even though it wasn't, you know what I mean? It just seemed like this. That's kind of what I think, you know, like, maybe not to beat the shit out of somebody or gang up on somebody, you know, but to have sex in the bathroom, you know, or go set, you know, a bush on fire or something, like, I don't know, like, something harmless. Well, fire's not harmless, but yeah, something was definitely lost. The people that went through that stuff, I think they are in touch with a kind of, man, it's going to sound really pretentious, but a flame that, you ever notice the age of bands that throngs of people go to see gets older and older? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, the bands,
yeah.
Certainly in the punk scene, the bands that draw a lot of people are the old heads. And it's because they went through it. They had to find it, first of all. And they had to get their ass beat on their way there or their way home, or worse. Somebody brought a human head to a show in Pittsburgh once. It was like, honestly, not even kidding, to a Sick of It All show. Crazy, crazy shit that should not happen and should not happen. Thank God it didn't happen to me, but it shouldn't happen to anybody, you know? So, yeah, man, like, I'm glad. Say, for example, it's harder to get jumped in certain cities. I was just down in Los Angeles, and, man, it's more expensive, you know, but being able to walk around downtown most hours of the day and night is a pretty cool change for me, having been going down there since my mid-20s. LA was a scary place back then. It's nice to not, like, think about getting attacked all the time, you know? So, I don't know. So it's just going to be weird. It's just, there's going to be something else, like electro or something like that, that's going to take off. And it's probably going to be in people's basements, you know? Or just, like, much like it was places like the Electric Banana, that was like a go-go club that somebody convinced to do all ages shows, and he started making money. If you don't pay the bands, it's an ATM. You know?
Well, there you have it. Wise words from Spike. Spike, thanks for coming on, man. It's been a real blast to have you on. We'll have to have you on again soon. Me, First and the Gimme Gimmes are going on tour in Europe starting June 21 through July 6. You can see them in Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Netherlands. Ooh, Netherlands, nice. France, Belgium, all around there. Then they'll be on tour in USA, mid-August, August 14th, starting on the West Coast, going down through Nevada, through Colorado, Arizona, up to Northern Cal, Washington, Oregon, and then back down to San Francisco and Monterey, ending September 7th. Brand new record, which you definitely should check out. Me versus the Gimme Gimmes, Blow That Madison's Quinceañera, June 14th. And we're going to play a track that is connected to Spike to a degree with the Seabury Brothers. We're going to play Psychotic Pineapple. I wanna.
Dropout.
Drop. There you go. We'll play Dropout. And Spike, listen, thanks again, man. It's been a real pleasure. And we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, man. Thank you guys both. Thank you, John. Thank you, Em.
Thanks for being on. Yeah, it was really great to meet you.